Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook. Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell-Fugerski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell-Fugerski, and I'm your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sunday of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. Another Fork in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain-injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anytime, and anywhere. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are 5.3 million people in the United States living with some form of brain injury. And domestic violence is a big part of that number. But most folks do not even know about brain injury. I know I never did, not until it came to live on my doorstep. On Another Fork in the Road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and caregivers experience. I interview brain injury survivors and caregivers, delving into their journeys to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I help therapists and other medical professionals to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And I host a professional panel discussion every first Sunday of every month. And we examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression or fatigue or anger management, to name a few. In the beginning of my journey as a host of the Brain Injury Radio Network, I shared my husband David's and my journey through the brain injury maze. If you missed any of my shows, you can find them in the archives at on demand at blogtalkradio.com/Brain Injury Radio. That's all one word, all lowercase. blogtalkradio.com/Brain Injury Radio. In the search box at the top, you can type my last name, Figurski. That's F as in Frank, I-G-U-R-S-K-I. Or you can type in the name of the show, Another Fork in the Road. But you can also find my archived shows on my blog at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. And that's, again, one word, all lowercase, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Just click the On the Air Show menu tab under the category section on the right sidebar. It's easy, and you can find a list of all the shows that I have done for the past 2 years, like more than 2 years now, I guess. And I think there are probably about 60 shows up there. So I hope you're going to find my show tonight informative and fun, and I hope you'll visit the shows of other hosts on Brain Injury Radio. There are shows every night between 5:30 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. Pacific Time. That would be 8:30 p.m. Eastern and all the way to 1 a.m. Eastern, and every time zone in between. Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States and in 36 countries. And when I mentioned that I'm hoping you'll listen to the shows of other hosts, I want to thank Lisa Dreyer for being on tonight. She is a host of, she has her own show on the Brain Injury Radio Network. So I'm hoping you'll tune into her show at some point too. The brain injury, this is a little bit of a an advertisement here for the network. The Brain Injury Radio Network offers survivor IDs, and these cards include your photo, your date of birth, all of your pertinent information, and contact emergency information. So you can protect yourself now for $19.95, and a portion of the proceeds will be returned to the Brain Injury Radio Network. So you can order your survivor ID at, all lowercase, all one word, survivorid.org. Or you can call 855-473-3711. Now, don't miss out. Now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And tonight's show is called Impulse versus Logical Thinking After Brain Injury. And I'm just going to give you just a little insight into this before I introduce my three panelists tonight. Logical decision-making seems kind of, well, like logical. But what is logical thinking? To me, it is using common sense, having a sound basis behind an idea. Logical thinking is coherent, well thought out, clear, and organized reasoning. Often, it takes a lot of time and energy to come to logical thinking. For example, what do I want to be when I grow up? We all have to think about that at some point in our lives, and that takes a lot of contemplation. One must analyze the kinds of things he or she likes to do. What is he or she good at? Where can he or she get the training to do it? Is it a viable occupation? So many of these questions need so many different answers. And logical thinking comes into play all the time. We use logical thinking every day without even knowing it. Impulse decision, on the other hand, is rash thinking. It may be a sudden, intense urge to do or say something that may or may not be appropriate. Have you ever done something on a whim, like taken a dare without considering the consequences? I have. I swung across a deep gully on a Tarzan vine when I was about 10 years old. I did it, and I fell. Not smart. But it was, for the moment, impulse. Obviously, I did not think through the consequences. Not only did I get hurt, I also ruined my yellow polka-dotted dress, and it was my favorite. Now, that wasn't even very smart, wearing a dress on Tarzan vine. I mean, come on. But I was only 10, so you have to give me a break there. But then I had to face my mother, who had forbidden me to ever go to the Tarzan vine. So impulse thinking or decisions often can get one in trouble, as it did me. Yet that kind of thinking happens frequently. After brain injury, many survivors deal with impulse decisions. Many times, these rash decisions get the survivor in trouble. A friend of mine said that for years after having a brain injury, she acted on impulse, not thinking through the consequences, and angered many of her friends to the point of losing them. She didn't do it on purpose. It just happened as a result of her brain injury. But now she lives with the regrets of the results. Impulse thinking is not a choice a survivor makes. It's the way his or her brain processes after brain injury. Folks who were logical thinkers before brain injury find themselves confused with this new way of thinking. Their caregivers, families, and friends do too. Oftentimes, too, the survivor is not even aware of his or her impulse behavior, which can be so frustrating for others who interact with him or her. We all make decisions. Some are logical, some are impulsive, and some are logically impulsive. As one of our panelists, Daniel Molino, as the guest tonight, informed me, we'll have Daniel explain that further in a few moments. Now I'd like to introduce you to my panel who will share their feelings about logical versus impulsive thinking after brain injury. And I mentioned Lisa Dreyer already. Lisa is a host on the Brain Injury Show. Lisa, want to tell us the name of your show?
Mess with MS.
Mess with MS. And I think if you're young, we're going to Lisa's show, you don't want to mess with MS because she knows a lot about it. So Lisa Dreyer is a survivor in the real sense of the world. Lisa entered the world 12 weeks early, weighing only 1 pound. She learned what it meant to be a survivor the moment she hit the earth. But to complicate matters, the lax care of a neonatal nurse responsible for Lisa caused Lisa to go into cardiac arrest. It wasn't until many years later, when a doctor shared the results of Lisa's CAT scan with her, that she realized her brain appeared abnormal. That hospital visit opened the door to finally attaching a label to a cocktail of illnesses: multiple sclerosis, lupus, epilepsy, Sjogren's syndrome, and TBI that Lisa would have to face. And I'm sure when Lisa talks to you, you'll find out that there are a lot more things that I didn't even list. But in June of 2015, Lisa was a guest on my show where she discussed her life before and after, realizing the many problems her brain was experiencing. So if you'd like to hear Lisa's entire show, you can, and her complete story, you can go to my blog. Again, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. On the right sidebar, click on the air show menu. Scroll to June 7th, 2015, and click on the title of the show. Lisa Dreyer, survivor of brain injury, multiple sclerosis, lupus, epilepsy, and Sjogren's syndrome is the title of that show. You can also find anybody that I'm referencing here by simply going to the search box and popping their name, typing their name into the search box, Lisa Dreyer, D-R-Y-E-R. And you'll find anything that Lisa has done on my blog, which has been extensive. My next guest tonight, my next panelist, is Georgiana Bell. Georgiana had her first brain injury when she was a six-year-old child. So we have two panelists today who have had their brain injury for a very, very long time. You might say a lifetime. She has had many more since then. Georgiana is glad to have a service dog. She's had several others over the years, and she's even trained them herself. To hear Georgiana discuss service dogs, go to my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, and on the right sidebar, again, click on the air show menu and scroll to August 7th. That's 2016. Okay, again, you can put her name in the search box, Georgiana Bell. Georgiana says in her Survivor's Speak Out interview on my blog that she has short and long-term memory loss, as well as cognitive issues. Mm-hmm. These are just two of the many problems that she lives with daily. Georgiana has also written a guest blog piece for my blog. To learn more about Georgiana, again, type her name in that search box in the right sidebar on my blog, and you will find all of the things that she has done for the blog. So welcome, Georgiana.
Thank you.
I'd also like to welcome Daniel Molino tonight. Daniel was a skydiver and apparently not afraid of heights. He never planned to dive from a 25-foot ladder, but that is what happened in 2010, causing Daniel's TBI. That was a game changer for him. Like the families of many survivors of brain injury, Daniel's family was told that he would probably not live. Boy, do I know that. I know that one too. But Daniel had other. Before his injury, Daniel was training for a cross-country bike journey, and he intended to make that dream happen. In March of 2015, Daniel set off from his home in New Jersey for his four-month trek across the United States, ending his journey in California. Often, brain injury survivors, I'm going to go back to Daniel there. I interviewed Daniel on a radio show on June 21st, 2015, and he did a survivor speak out interview on November 7th, 2014. So you get the drill. Go to survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, type in Daniel's name, or you can, basically that's probably the easiest thing for that. type in Daniel Molino's name. That's Molino with two L's, M-O-L-L-I-N-O. So I'm going to welcome everybody, and then thank you all for joining me tonight, Daniel, Lisa, and Georgiana. I'm really pleased to have
thank
you with
you.
Me.
Thank you.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about logical thinking for a minute. And I was just thinking about when someone might use a logical thinking. And I thought about buying a car. Because we all know that that takes a little bit of thinking, or it should. But what color, what amenities do we want on the car? That's logical thinking, to figure out what you need. If you were in a family of four, a two-seater sports car would not work for you. Even though it is sharp-looking, and you can imagine all the fun you would have driving it, you'd better stick to that SUV crossover. But many people make impulse decisions and regret them later. I think that's one of the hardest things about the impulse decision-making. As I mentioned earlier with my friend who said that, you know, she just made a lot of impulse decisions that were incorrect. They just weren't good, and people got annoyed, and she ended up losing a lot of friends. So, it happens with brain injury, so we have to figure out how we can help that and how we can change it, or what can we do. Brain injury survivors with frontal lobe injury are more often affected by the problems with impulse control, and survivors may act without thinking. They may lack patience and find it difficult to wait their turn in a conversation. This would be highly distractible behavior for anyone. But I'm thinking now with Georgiana and Lisa, who have had their brain injuries from childhood, how this would affect them in a classroom. So, Lisa and Georgiana, I'm going to throw this question at you. Lisa, you had your brain injury at birth, and Georgiana at age six. Did either of you find impulsivity was a problem for you in school? And if so, what did your school days look like? Just identify yourself before you talk so we know who's talking.
This is Georgiana. Mine started literally right after my head injury. I was in first grade. I couldn't sit still. The teachers, well, I was in a Catholic school at the time, nuns would actually tell me that I need to sit still, stop wiggling in my chair, stop moving, and I'd still keep moving and everything else. I couldn't sit still for 4 seconds, let alone 2 seconds.
Hmm.
But, you know, there's things that I'd do, like get up and just move around for unknown reasons. And finally, after leaving the Catholic school that was in Mahwah, New Jersey, I ended up being taken out and going to Tuxedo Public School. I had a lot of problems there where I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't do anything correctly. I was impulsive in my ways of not being able to listen correctly, follow directions properly, doing anything that I really wanted to do, that I should be doing actually in a classroom. If a teacher told me to do such and such, I would try to do it, but then couldn't follow through or remember to continue doing it, and they would consider that impulsive behavior. Finally, after sixth grade, they finally said, no, you got to go to BOCES special ed in Goshen, New York, which I actually physically graduated from. But there was a lot of things as I got older that ended up becoming more apparent, like behaviors like run away. I was a runaway. I ran away to New Jersey a lot to get out of the state of New York. This way I couldn't. They couldn't extradite me back to New York very well. Mm. And I ended up having a lot of bad things happen to me, rape, because of, you know, things that I would do and places I'd put myself in, and not being able to think logically, I guess you could say, on this is going to harm me one way or another, and just doing the impulsive move by going and just doing it instead of thinking it through. And my father always used to tell me, think before you speak. And he still does that to this very day. And that's something that I end up having a lot of problems with. I've gotten a little bit better as I got older, but it's still things along those lines that I can't stop and think about what I'm going to do before I do it. I do it, and then I end up getting in trouble for it or something ends up happening. So there's a lot of things that have happened to me throughout my lifetime in school where I couldn't actually follow through properly, and I'd get in trouble because of that impulsive behavior.
Lisa, I just want to follow up with your Jenna for a minute. After you've done this impulsive behavior, especially something as drastic as your what you said about running away and definitely even out of the state, do you ever reflect back on it and realize at that point that this was not such a good choice? And does that ever come into play for you?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, when I look back at placing myself in different predicaments, like groups that I didn't know, just trusting people willy-nilly and not listening to my inner feelings and just going about what I'm fine, you know, just I'm doing it, and I go, and it put me in situations, again, like I was raped 5 different times, placing myself in detrimental harm. I mean, physical detrimental harm to myself, my emotion, my psyche. So, I mean, there's things like that. And like I said, during school, I couldn't sit still. I wouldn't listen to the teachers. I was told not to do such and such, and I'd do it anyways. It became really bad, and I wish I never did half those things, but it was nothing I could have stopped.
Did you try to stop it, like in school when the teacher told you to
sometimes,
sit still?
Yes. Sometimes, yes, I did, but then I ended up just going full-blown on it anyways and not listening to who I thought was actually right or even my inner feelings again. I just up and did it. And it was a lot worse as a teenager than it is today as an adult. And I do regret many of the things that I did.
But as a child there, I'm going back to that again, you were, even though you may have wanted to comply with the teacher's wishes and sit still, you probably were not able to. You know, I don't think
not
you
really
that
well.
Choice
no,
in that.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not very well at all. That's one of the problems that I had when I was in Catholic school because they didn't know how to handle me. I think it was like 10 or 11 kids in the class. And, of course, back then they didn't know in the 80s, the early 80s, that my head injury took place in 1980. They didn't know anything about head injuries back then. So they didn't know about the impulsivity and the behavior aspect, the moodiness that I had from my frontal lobe brain damage or anything along those lines. They just knew I couldn't read, I couldn't write, I couldn't talk right, I had to be put here, I had to go there. You know, and they just didn't know what to do. That's why I was taken out of Catholic school in Mahwah and placed back in the public school. Well, I never went to public school, but they placed me in public school at third grade at Tuxedo. So it was really complicated with having to go to reading classes, special ed classes, resource classes, you know, being told all the time I was lazy. That one used to get me a lot. Oh, you're lazy. Mm-hmm. I'm not really lazy because I actually tried to do a lot of things, and then after a while I just got sick of it, you know, because I was constantly being told, well, you're not doing this, you're not trying hard enough, but I was. And then finally I did. I just gave up. You know, I did.
You know,
I
think it's
interesting
that you're saying this because I think that teachers, and I'm a teacher, so I'm coming from that area. I taught first and third grade, and we were never really trained to work with children with brain injury. And because, if you remember in my introduction, I only learned about brain injury when my husband had it in 2005. Prior to that, I didn't even really know it. I did teach some years after that, but never really we didn't have workshops or any kind of training on on what to do with a child who is identified with a brain injury. Frankly, right. I'm not sure how many children are identified with a brain injury. I think they're, because in classrooms, I've had children that were very disruptive and almost to a point of unable to control themselves, much like what you're talking about. And
right.
I didn't understand that. And I do now, but I didn't really understand that. I would sit with the parents over and over and say, your child won't sit in his seat. And my classroom was not a sit-in-your-seat type thing. It was just a bunch of things that you can choose to do. It's a very free, open space. But they would still choose to disrupt as opposed to focusing on anything. And now I'm not sure that word choose is correct. They may not have been able to focus it wasn't a choice for them. So what you're saying is quite enlightening to me, and I wish if I could go back into the classroom now, which I can't, I'm well beyond that classroom type age. But I would like to look at children differently in that way.
It was difficult because I got thrown all the time, like into the wolves, I guess you could say. Thrown into the wolves. But the thing is that like doctors would keep telling my parents, well, she has severe ADHD. She is ADD. She has severe learning disabilities. All these other things that would, she's impulsive. She's reactive. She's moody. And I'm just like, why am I this way? And it didn't click in until after I was probably in my early 20s that, now I know why,
Yeah. Boy, it's like a little late at that point when you're going through that and being so confused.
Exactly.
Lisa, do you have any, can you relate to what Georgiana is talking about right now?
Yes. I went through my early childhood development, and I was always, I was in small classes. I was, in IEP classes when I was older in high school. But when I was younger, I was mostly in private school, and I was in small classes because that's what the people around me felt that I could take. And it was really wonderful for me and for my growth. And really, I think for the rewiring of my brain. Because I had had trauma on my brain. And it really did work to make my brain healthy again. And the neuroplasticity, I guess, of my brain.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to grow. As in my childhood, because when I was very little, when I was a baby, my brain basically stopped. So I had a very traumatic thing happen to it, and it needed to be started up again pretty severely. So all that, the ability to be in those small classes and be around teachers who cared about me, and it really worked. My brain grew with that because I found nurturing classes good for me.
So kind of yours was kind of, story is kind of the opposite of Georgiana's, where she wasn't feeling that nurturing and she was just feeling the frustration of her instructors because they didn't quite understand what was going on either.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to add something there, Georgiana?
I just agreeing with you 100% because I didn't even get that from my own parents, let alone from my teachers. And it was extremely difficult for me. And I had to learn to become normal as whatever normal might be to fit in because I never fit in anywhere, no matter what I tried to do. That's one of the reasons why I left New York, New Jersey area. Because I never fit in. It was always something misplaced. And I felt, oh, gosh, the thing, it was just, I didn't feel comfortable. No matter how hard I tried all my life, it just never felt like I fit in anywhere. It was so complicated for me.
Yeah, that's got to be a horrible feeling. One of our guests in the chat room asked a question of you, and he wanted to know if you felt that the special ed designation that you had, did that make you feel uncomfortable also?
Actually, I felt a lot better in both these. I felt like I was with people that had similar problems. A lot of them had spina bifida, Down syndrome, mental illnesses, severe mental illnesses, anything like that. So I felt like I was more connected with people somehow, some way, that I was more understood.
That's interesting. So, that's a very interesting thing because
in ninth grade, one of the biggest mistakes New York State made was in ninth grade, they took me out of BOCES in the middle of ninth grade and stuck me back in public school. It was the worst thing they ever did for me because I flunked, I got raped, I was abused, I got beaten by people at my home school. It was really, really bad. It was one of the worst things New York State could ever do to me, and I wish they never did, and I wish they would have just left me at BOCES because I was doing fine. I was a straight-A student there.
Wow. Well, you know why they didn't? It's called dollar signs. You know, they're going to put you back into a mainstream classroom as soon as they possibly can because it costs a lot of money, a lot of tax dollar money to educate in special ed. And I know that because I had to fight for students in my classroom who absolutely needed it. And literally I was taking these problems home and working on them and trying to get these children the help that they needed. And it was very delayed because of the money situation in the school. And that's wrong.
Yeah.
That's terribly wrong because, as you said, you were doing well in the one situation in the BOCES school. BOCES is, I can't remember what that stands for. Do you know what the acronym is? I should know it, but I don't.
I don't, but I can look it up if you want me to.
Yeah, if you have a chance, go ahead. That's a common, I think it's actually in Jersey, too, so it might be something more than just New York.
No, from
that,
what I understand, it's only New York and California that they have a BOCES.
Okay.
Well, let's see here.
So both of you had issues with Lisa, not so much in school because you had a smaller situation and with people that were more nurturing. But that is so crucial when somebody has a brain injury or is having these difficulties, whether we know it's a brain injury or not, we still have to kind of delve into finding out what's making that child respond in the way that he or she is responding. And that takes a lot of time by a lot of people, a lot of specialists in school systems. But Georgiana, you also said that you didn't have the support from your parents. Did they not understand that you had a brain injury, or was that
my father witnessed it? My father witnessed my brain injury. If it wasn't for him, I would have been dead. He was a firefighter in New York for 32 years. He was behind me when I lost control of my bicycle and watched me flip my bike and land directly on the cement head first, doing about 30 miles per hour on a bike. So when he picked me up, he basically scraped me off the floor of the ground of the earth and brought me into what was my, he's now a bishop in New York State, Mr. Langberg's house, which they called my mom to come pick me up and my dad up. And I had an outer body experience. My father was doing things for me to try to keep me up and going and alive. There was a lot of things that took place between that time to the time I got in there. I was in a coma for like 72 hours. And I was, they took me to Good Samaritan Hospital in Suffern, New York. And I got the care. They were supposed to drill into my head to relieve pressure. I can't remember, a lobotomy or something like that. But thank God, knock on wood, that the actual medication that my pediatrician was actually giving me was sort of decreasing the swelling of the brain. I ended up having eye problems, and I'm deaf in my left ear. I had optic nerve damage that didn't appear until fifth and sixth grade. I had to go through therapy on that to regain vision because I lost vision completely in my left eye. My left ear, I still can't hear out of. I've been offered to get special hearing aids, and I just don't want to deal with it. I've tried. I just don't want to bother with it. But there's a bunch of things. I mean, also to go back a little bit, BOCES stands for Board of Cooperative Educational Services.
Okay. I never heard it called outside the full name, but thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. Sorry about that.
That's okay. You said your father saw this happen, and he was there to help you out, but he didn't realize it. And I'm wondering again, too, I think brain injury has only come to the forefront in the past maybe 10 years, if that might even be giving it a larger margin. I think once the church started coming back from the rock and they started to realize that they're having brain injury from the explosions, the IEDs that are going off under them, and that started the headlines of brain injury, and we started to read about it. And I think that's when it started to become a more common term. Still, I think a lot of people don't understand it. Then we also have now the football players that's even more recent, the NFL. Concussion discussions and everything. And I think that kind of is all really within the past year or two now. I'm wondering, like me, if your father didn't even understand brain injury, even though he saw it. He saw you get it. But what do most people worry about when they're taking you to the hospital? Did you break anything? Did you break your arm?
Nobody really understood it. And see, today's day and age, it was 94. I graduated in 92. 1994 or 96, I can't remember which year, was the year that New York State actually said anybody before the age of 18 has a developmental disability if they sustained a brain injury like mine. I missed by 2 to 3 years to become DDD. I would have been able to get a heck of a lot more services, be able to recover better if I would have been labeled developmentally disabled like most of the other kids are today. But because I wasn't able to get that label, I ended up struggling my whole life. And I still do to this very day because I was never able to get the services that I actually needed to learn to recover.
Right, and I think that is a case of the sign of the times, that people just didn't know about it. That's why I'm thinking you said your father didn't know. I think the doctors really didn't have a sense of it either.
I want to move on to another
part right now because Daniel's probably falling asleep over there. Daniel, a few weeks – are you still there?
I'm still here.
Good. A few weeks back, you and I talked about the possibility of making impulsively logical decisions, or was it logically impulsive decisions? I began to think about that. a lot after we talk. And but first, I just not Daniel, what I said earlier, that's an oxymoron. You can't do that. That's not possible. But then I began to think, and you might have some other ideas on this too, but I want to see if I'm right on this. In cooking, I often impulsively throw in another ingredient that would logically go with the recipe. So that could be logically impulsive. And while at the clothes store, I once spotted a green scarf that I knew would match my purple dress. I bought it. Again, logically impulsive. Actually,
ooh,
that's not a true story, but it does make the point.
It sounds like a creative thinking.
It has
yeah.
polka dots on it, too. Oh, I said that. It had polka dots. It has stripes, too, yellow stripes. Okay, we'll just make this really, really ridiculous. But, Daniel, can you talk about logically impulsive decisions, and when have you made them, and have they worked out for good or bad or both?
The term itself is generally ones that would work out in the best possible scenario. It comes from many of the sports that I've done, which between skydiving, scuba, cycling, rock climbing, the list is long. But you train when everything goes wrong. You train impulses in a way. You learn
uh-huh.
actions that can mitigate the situation and hopefully save your tail. So it really comes from there, because when you're climbing and, say, you lose your grip and you start falling,
uh-huh.
you need to act impulsively. Same under skydiving when you have a canopy failure. It's not something you get a chance to think about, especially in skydiving. You've got a minute before you're going to hit the ground if your canopy completely fails. So you created the impulse in your body to immediately follow the instructions of how to cut away the canopy and get the reserve out. Same applies in cycling. There's a lot of areas. People don't realize they become acclimated or accustomed to that style. But
mm-hmm.
the basis of it is that your impulsive action is one based upon logic. You generally have to learn it beforehand, of course, because
yeah.
there's lack of time to think. You know.
So if I'm driving down a street and a dog runs out in front of me, I am going to swerve, which would be logically
right.
impulsive, right?
Correct.
Because
hopefully you swerve in the right direction.
Know, yeah, hopefully. Well, then it's logically, I don't know what else. It didn't work. So that made sense to me once I thought about it that way. So you can be both. But again, it's in certain situations, I think, that would happen that would be more favorable for. Like you, when you said sports or riding your bike as you rode across the country, I bet you found some pebbles on the road that you wanted to avoid or little potholes or whatever. So if
yep.
you would use your common sense or your logical sense to quickly swerve out of there, and you'd have to make that decision really within seconds, like you said, probably less than seconds, immediately, in order to avert an accident happening or something not so great. Have you ever had done an impulsive decision like that, a logically impulsive decision that didn't work out for you?
Two parachute failures, so yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
what do
yeah.
you mean by that? What happened?
One time I had a line over, which means one of the lines under the canopy was actually over top of it. Creates a bow tie if it's dead center. Mine wasn't that bad. And then the second time, I had a line twist, meaning when the canopy came out, the lines coming down to me were twisted up. And my choice was try to untwist them or get under a good canopy. And based on height and everything else, getting under a good canopy made more sense.
Uh-huh. So those are flip-second decisions that have to be made for life-saving.
Much.
Frankly. Wow,
yeah,
you do
much.
Do a lot
you're
of
reserved.
Daring things, don't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's much logic in that side of the equation, but yes.
Yeah, I know. I'm not sure about that either. But you're not alone. There are a lot of people out there skydiving.
Oh, yeah.
You're never going to see me do that. Yeah, my husband was a race car driver. Give me time. No, that's not going to happen, Daniel. I can pretty much assure you.
Hey, just got to get you in the airplane.
With the door closed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh God, that would not be something I would do. So I did go boating this weekend, and that was perfectly fine. And I would even ski behind a boat, but jumping out of an airplane, I'm not too sure.
It's actually safer than landing in the airplane. Just saying.
Yeah, it probably is, but I think we won't go there either.
Yeah,
I know I'm going to be flying an airplane.
Well, yeah, we all travel eventually, right?
Oh, yeah. So, Lisa and Georgiana, how was each of you affected by logical or impulsive thinking, other than the things that we just spoke of? As an adult now, we talked about your early life as children. Do you feel like you're a more logical thinker, or do you think you're a more impulsive thinker, or do you feel that you're a mixture of both?
Mixture of both.
I'm definitely a mixture of both. I have to work on being a logical person. I definitely am an emotional thinker,
mm-hmm.
so that's less logical than I would like to be, because it's emotional.
And that's another,
my brain injury.
That's another area we can explore, emotional thinking.
Yeah. My brain injury affected the emotional parts of my brain, like the hippocampus and the amygdala. And so my problems with self-awareness and social interactions have changed since my MS has, you know, come into play. And I have recognized that, that there's definitely some kind of thing going on in my frontal lobe. I definitely have made some decisions that I wouldn't have made, when I was, not sick. That have made me a less happy person, and have made others around me less happy with me. And I think that it's a defensive thing. Your brain is acting defensively because it knows that something's wrong.
Anybody else have any comment on that?
Yeah. Not really. It's her thing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, from emotional essences with impulses, generally speaking, that's when emotion gets involved in things, it tends to actually make the decisions not the best.
Right.
The most common thing taught in many sports, especially ones with risk, is actually trying to separate emotion from everything, because once you get the emotion of fear, your decision goes out the window. If your emotion gets to I can't think of the right word. I'm just going to have to say cocky, but whatever that word might be, where you're high and mighty, that's when you're going to also start making major mistakes. And it's all going to be based upon an impulse. Your ability to go through things in a logical manner, even if it's a fast-paced logical manner, gets very shaded by the emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree.
I'm not a sports person, but I am a theater person, and I think that a lot of times logic kind of goes out the window sometimes, and you just fly by the seat of your pants by what you're doing. You go through your your emotional core. But I mean, you've gone through training to get there. So really, it's not quite true because you have a center there.
Very true.
Yeah. One of the things, this is Georgiana, one of the things that has happened with me took place in 2005. When I became seriously mentally ill, I got placed into the Arizona Seriously Mentally Ill program, and I was at what was called Value Options at the time. A lady, I was acting out of impulse again, and I was just aggressive. Normally, I have aggressive impulses. That's my most biggest problem. A lady came up behind me and grabbed my shirt. Well, in New York, when I grew up, if somebody came around and pulled on me, that was the end of it. It was a brawl, all-out brawl.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what ended up happening was I was on the phone with my attorney at the time when it was going on, and this lady's like, no, you are going to do this. I'm like, no, I'm not doing that, you know, and then she goes, Georgiana, you're doing it. And as she said it like that, she pulled on my shirt. That's when I turned. The phone flew out of my hand, and it hit her. And she said I punched her, but I didn't. But the phone hit her, and I ended up getting an assault charge placed on me in 2005 because of that incident, because I acted out of impulse instead of acting
mm-hmm.
out logically.
Right.
Yeah.
But it was almost like a provoked, you know, provoked.
To
action.
Me, yes. And that's why I thought I would
that.
Be fine in court, but I wasn't. I still ended up getting slammed with the assault. So.
Did she get?
No. She got nothing. Nope, she got nothing. Not a thing. That's what irritated me because I thought I was in the right for protecting myself because the way I used to grow up was somebody touches you, you fight back. That's the way I was
mm-hmm.
raised. And you protect yourself. And I figured I was in the right, but apparently I wasn't. So now I become anybody. I was, again, this was church, maybe about 6 years ago now. I was helping a lady train her dog, and another lady piped in, and I was trying to help her train this little dog for her diabetes, and the one lady came over, and she grabbed me and physically threw me into the pew. I just sat there and took it because I was afraid of the because of what I learned from that incident back in 2005, I just took it, and I sat there, and I took her beating, and I dealt with it because now I'm afraid to react again because now I don't want to be sitting in jail for 72 hours because they're saying that I punched a lady when I never did. The phone actually did hit her. So, but either way, I reacted in a way that I thought I was right, but I was wrong. So that's why I just take my beatings now and let it go.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Kind of a hard lesson, huh?
Yeah, it was, because I never want to be there again, put it that way simply. And if I ever was, it wouldn't be long-term. Put it that way lightly.
This kind of brings me into the next area and about filters. And often brain injury survivors lack filters. And yours wasn't so much a lacking of a filter, it was a response. But that means when they're lacking filters, that means that they do not always understand that the types of things they blurt out may or may not be appropriate. For example, asking personal questions of strangers or sharing overly personal information with strangers, making the stranger feel uncomfortable, can place the survivor and his or her caregiver in an awkward position. And the survivor interviewees on my blog said that once he realized that he needed to, and these are his words, stop and think before blurting out his random thoughts, his life improved. And he said that his caregiver's life improved as well. I'm wondering, perhaps a prearranged signal from a caregiver, a family member, or a friend could be used to alert the survivor of inappropriate behavior.
Yes,
I'm hearing agreement.
It can be, and it works. It works for me at least.
That's good. I want to go into that in just a minute. I wanted to just tell a story about David. David and I developed a sign when I needed to privately let him know something. It's only one. We've only had, we talked about this yesterday. I said, do we have any other signs? And he couldn't think of any, and I didn't either. But sometimes when he's eating, a food particle will cling to his lip. And David has a swallow disorder, and his face is partially paralyzed on the right. So he's not able to chew the food easily. And very often he'll bite his lip or his tongue or the side of his mouth. So he has to be very, very careful. But he doesn't have the feeling over there like we all do. And if you have a little speckle of food on your lip, you're going to usually feel it. But he doesn't. So when I see that, especially when we're out eating with friends and things like that, I discreetly touch my lip where in the same area that his little food is clinging to his, and he immediately knows to wipe it away. And this, I know this isn't an impulse situation, but the alert works the same way. And I'm thinking it might be a good idea to set behavior modification actions in motion for people who have filter issues. And maybe just saying S&T or can trigger the S&T, the stop and think idea. Do any of you, Georgia, and I know you right away said yes, this works for you. So can you talk about that and Daniel and Lisa, if this is affects you in any way? Do you use any kind of behavior mod signals to help you with your, Daniel, with your wife and Lisa and Georgiana with your families?
I'm not sure I understand how to answer that.
let me explain something. I've been living with Stephen for a very long time. He's known me since, I think 3 years old or so. One of the things is he's learned how I will react to something, and I'm very reactive. And he'll know before I know if I'm going to react to something. Well, he'll actually clip his, do his fingers like that. And then, hey. And then I snap out of it, and I'm like, oh, okay. And that makes me realize, oh, okay, I should not go off on this person, or I should shut my mouth or whatever, because of the way I was going to respond. Again, I have a lot of aggressive impulses. My whole frontal lobe is pretty much damaged. But the thing is that I outburst a lot. And I'm not comfortable with situations if I'm placed in a situation, even if I don't even place myself in that situation. Matter of fact, going through food stamp issues, I've been investigated recently, and I was being very uncomfortable asking these questions. I'm like, I don't want to answer these questions. I was very uncomfortable answering them, but I was being pushed to, and I felt like I was being bullied almost. And I'm like, don't bully me, And I became aggressive. And I'm like, don't you dare bully me. How dare you, And I went off. And finally, I realized after talking to my power of attorney, which is Stephen, he said, you have no choice but to deal with them. And that's when I sat back and was like, all right, fine. And I shut my mouth. I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever, all right, yeah, me, So then I changed my attitude right away, But it's his signaling a lot. My mom and dad, they don't do nothing for me. Some people may do it where they'll say, why are you acting like that? Acting like what? I'm like, this is me, and really, it's not, and I realize I'll sit back and go, ooh, yeah, okay, I see what I was doing wrong. And sometimes it might not be for days that I realize, oh, I did this or I reacted that way or whatnot, you know, it becomes complicated. But that signaling that Stephen does works for me 100%. Nobody else like him. I think Catherine's done it to me once, but Stephen, no matter what, all the time, every single time, it's 100%. I'm able to pull myself out and be like, oh, okay, I need to back off a little bit, you know, and calm mm-hmm. down and think about it more logically before I just go, bah! And that's basically
yeah.
what I do. I explode.
Yeah. Well, it's almost a learning thing, too. You have to be able to be in sync with the other person who was doing it. Like you said, Stephen is able to do that, and that's something that you've learned. It's almost like a conditioning in a way. You know, where
he
snaps the fingers and it brings you to realizing what's going on, and you're able to adjust your behavior at that point. And
exactly.
I mean, and again, I said David isn't impulse, but it, again, it's that signal. I think a lot of married couples have those kinds of signals too. You're at a party and you want to go, and you can just kind of raise your eyebrows or something, or do something, scratch your wrist.
Yeah.
And the other person knows, okay, this is the time we have to get out of here. So, I mean, people do make the little signals like for different things. But, again, they have to both understand those signals. They have to be able to agree upon them, and then they can act upon them. And for us, that works really well. David's not embarrassed because I didn't say, hey, David, you got something on your lip. You know, and nobody even really notices it because we've done it so discreetly. And I'm just wondering if there are other little tricks that we might suggest for people who have to deal with the lack of filters or being aggressive or any of the number of things that happen to people with brain injury. Does anybody else have any kind of a suggestion or anything that you might do? Daniel, do you understand what I'm getting at now?
Yeah, the responses to relationship style situations and that type of stuff, the impulses and reactions. That's about right, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I just want to make sure. I mean, it's a learning experience afterwards when you start getting everything back together. But the thing that I've always gone with, I have a stress ball. So when I start to get a little out, I tend to try to sit back and go through it as opposed to responding when mad. But I don't really get that way that often, so for me it's a little hard to relate. I'm more
right.
of the mellow kind of person, so me and my wife really don't have very many arguments. I think our only arguments have been, like, stupid things about who's taking up too much of the bed, which for the record is always her, you know.
Yeah. No, I think some of these kinds of things, like if someone is going to be losing it a little bit, lacking the filter, becoming more aggressive, not you know, saying things that he or she should not be saying,
right.
if there's a signal, like maybe redirecting the conversation, you know, changing the topic, changing the area. You know, getting the person
Stephen
to go to a different
me.
Area.
Yeah,
Let's
Stephen
that
does that for me a lot. So,
It
seems to work between him and I, and it doesn't seem to work with others. Okay. The only other time I've had it happen with somebody else was a cop who was actually being calm with me and knew, because this was at the mental health clinic in Apache Junction. I went off because of what happened back in January. And I went off, I was going off on my case manager, I was screaming, I was yelling, throwing things, you know, having a temper tantrum, basically, as I call them. And the cop came over and didn't touch me. He just said, hello, you need to calm down. And I'm like, and he's like, hello, you need to calm down. And finally I was like, oh, okay. And I snapped out of it then. But normally that's what Stephen does for me all the time. And he can break me no matter what, 100% every single time I can snap right out of it with him. Everybody else, it's not that easy. I don't know what
it
is between
like,
him and I.
I'm just thinking it might be a trust issue. You might feel comfortable with him and you trust him, and you know that when he says something, it's for your benefit. That's how
I agree with you on that. I think that's very logical because I trust
logical
him.
Logical thinking.
Yeah. No, I really do. He's basically the only man I've ever trusted in my life. I don't even trust my own father. I trust him 100%. So, I think it has a lot to do with my past from rape and stuff too. So
yeah, of course.
That I get very socially anxious with all people. I mean, even family, friends, everyone. It doesn't matter how long I've known them or anything. I have anxiety. And people doubt that. People think that, you know, I don't have anxiety. I'm not afraid. But I am. I do have social anxiety, and it makes me act in certain ways. And I've learned how to, I think, mask my social anxiety. And I got pretty good at a person who was a fun person rather than a not fun person. And that is a good way to mask your social anxiety. But now, like, I'm 35. I don't need to do that so much. The time of my life where I'm going to parties and being with friends in that kind of way is over. I really don't care what people are saying, if they're whispering or whatnot, because I'm usually just at home with my boyfriend and my dog.
So you're keeping yourself in a comfortable environment, and and it's good, Lisa, to know that you understand yourself in that way. You know?
Yeah.
That's good. I like what you do. One of the things that I ended up doing was I actually placed myself in an uncomfortable position. I don't like going to bars, never really have, always had that social anxiety. Well, when I wanted to start working on myself, I actually went out to a bar. I actually sat in the corner by myself. I didn't care what people thought. They pointed, they laughed, they, you know, made comments. Good for them. But it took me about 6 months to finally come out of my shell and be able to go over and start talking to these people and be like, hey, my name is Georgiana. How you doing? What you doing today? I'm from New York, blah, 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 blah. You know, and they were like, oh, okay, now we know who the oddball girl sitting in the corner has been, you know. So, I mean, I actually forced myself to do that. And a lot of the times I will put myself into a situation, and that might be impulsive, but I'm also trying to work on myself too, because I know in the back of my mind, okay, I'm going to be able to run from this situation, okay? And that's one of my biggest things. If I cannot get out of the situation and leave it, I won't put myself into it. If I start getting scared or uptight, I want to be able to walk out the door and not show back up until I'm darn good and ready. And that's one of the things that I made sure of. I investigated the bar. There was three outs. There was three different doors I could walk out of. There was a place that I could go and run if I needed to, if I just needed to, okay, good, I feel better, let's go, you know. But I did that. I made sure of that, and then I put myself in these predicaments intentionally so I could actually become more social because I knew I needed it.
It sounds like you were logically figuring this out. You figured out a lot of different angles.
Logical impulse.
Yeah. There you go. Okay, I have one more thing that I wanted to go into before we have to start thinking about closing down, because it's getting late already. But that lack of planning or minimal organizational skills can strip away logic. So can lack of concentration. When someone is not able to focus, it makes it difficult for them to make logical decisions. Are there any ways for survivors to work on focus and logical thinking? And I say yes, there are. Because there are programs out there on the web that may help. And that operational word there is may. Not going to help for everybody. Different brain injuries are unique. They're different. They are like snowflakes. They are like fingerprints. Nobody has the same kind of a brain injury. So no, there is no solution for overall brain injury. But there are some things out there that folks may want to give a try to see if it doesn't help them to focus a little bit more, to work on logical thinking. And one of those things is called luminosity. And a lot of people may have heard it. It's advertised a lot. And it's a program that my husband has tried, and actually he likes it. It uses puzzles and games and mathematical equations to stretch the brain. So you have to use your logical thinking in order to figure out where, you know, if A equals B and B equals C, what does D equal? Probably nothing. I don't know. But word games like Word with Friends, you're still going to be using some strategy there, trying to get the highest points to win the game with your friends. It's kind of like a Scrabble game. These are free games on the web. Just go to an app and find them. Solitaire, any kind of the solitaire games are going to cause you to use your brain and stretch your brain and try. Some of it's luck, but not all of it. You know, it's the card you're dealt, but not all of it. And it's a matter of where you place the cards at the right at time. Cards like spades or gin rummy can help with logical thinking too. And I think these are good for anybody, especially as you get older, when you've got the elderly society. I think that these are good for them to keep their brain working and on target. You might want to visit, there's a site for my friend Ann Boriski, and she has a site called Brain Injury Peer Visitor, and it's located at, I bet you can guess, braininjurypeervisitor.org. It's all one word, all lowercase. Brain Injury Peer, like P-E-E-R, visitor. And Anne was a guest on my show some months ago, and she's offers a lot of wonderful information on her site. But I poked around and found tools and aids. You can find it on the left sidebar, tools and aids. And there she has tons of activities or links to get to activities to help with just logical thinking, you know, focusing, strategy thinking. So I'm putting those out there for folks who want to, challenge your brain, stretch it a little bit. And maybe it will help with the logical thinking and overcome some of the impulse thinking that is going on. And so now we are coming close to the end of our show, so I just want to ask my guests, Daniel and Lisa and Georgia. Anna, do you have anything else you'd like to add to tonight?
No, I'm good, thank you.
No, I'm pretty good. If anyone wants to look up my name on Facebook, though, I'll be doing the Red Bull 400 and ride the rim of Crater Lake this month, so there will be photos and videos. And also I have a video going up that's a short one. Donna, you may like it also. That'll be going up on Tuesday. It's only a minute and a half long, though.
Can you tell us your website? Is it danielmolino.com?
On Facebook, just Daniel Molino. And I have a profile, but also have a public page. So go to the public page that says public figure. Nice and simple.
Okay. So
and the website is TBITO. And then the word victory.com.
Go to victory?
TBI2.
No, say that again.
Victory.
TBI2 victory.
Yep.
TBI2 victory. Yes, okay. I've been there many times, but I didn't write it down, so I don't have it memorized. But, check out Daniel's site for sure, because you'll see his travel across country, the northern part of the United States, last summer, as he went from New Jersey, my old home state. Actually, Daniel and I didn't know each other in New Jersey, but we would have if I hadn't moved out to the desert. I met Daniel after I moved out to the desert, but I have no doubt that at some time we will meet in person.
I'll be down that way sometimes.
Oh, absolutely, and you're always welcome. And Georgiana is a neighbor of mine, meaning an hour away or so. She is a desert dweller with me. And Lisa used to be a desert dweller here, and she moved to Cleveland before we got a chance to meet. But I have no doubt. I've met Georgiana in person. I have no doubt I'll be meeting my friend Lisa at some point, too. So thank you all. Lisa, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Just you can listen to my show. I'm on Saturdays, and you can look me up on the Brain Injury Radio Network or on Facebook and, let's see, every other thing out there. I'm on YouTube, and I'm on Pinterest. You can look me up. So look me up under Lisa Dreyer online. Thanks.
That's Dreyer. And Lisa's show, Mess with MS, airs on the Brain Injury Radio Network at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time every second and fourth Saturday of the month. So tune into her show. She always has some interesting guests. And which I guess is a gift, and some great topics. And Georgiana,
that's a wonderful guest.
Yeah. And Georgiana, again, I want to thank you for joining us, and hope to take another recumbent ride with you sometime in the near future.
Me too. Thank you for having me.
Okay. All right, and I'm going to sign off now. Good night, everybody. But before I do say that, I want to thank Daniel Molino, Lisa Dreyer, and Georgiana Bell for sharing so much of their lives and offering hope to other survivors and this wonderful topic about impulse versus logical thinking. I think we kind of got into that in depth, and it was pretty interesting. And we just told you where you can learn more about Daniel and his website, and also Lisa. You can read interviews about TBI survivors and caregivers on my blog at SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. You can find more information about Daniel Molino, Lisa Dreyer, and George Annabelle on my blog. Simply type their name in the search box. It makes it easy to find anything they have done on there. There is a category in my blog for brain injury resources, and one that shouts out the accomplishments, big and small, called Itty Bitty Giant Steps. So if you have an accomplishment that you'd like to share, please contact me on my blog. Again, the address is SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com, or you can just go ahead and email me at neelyf@aol.com. That's N is in Nancy, EELYS@AOL.com. If you are going to contact me, please make sure you put into the subject line something to identify yourself so it doesn't go to spam. There's a wonderful section called Guest Bloggers, which gives my readers another perspective from other writers. You can find Georgiana there. You can read about my book, which we never mentioned here, but it's called Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Story. It's in search for an agent and a publisher right now. So I hope that you'll join me on my next show in 2 weeks, on September 19th, when David Grant and his wife Sarah talk about their lives together. David and Sarah they're both very strong advocates for brain injury survivors. And David has had a brain injury as well. David and Sarah published TDI Hope and Inspiration, an online magazine, and you can find several of my articles in there too, so look me up in that. But so come, you know, make sure you tune in 2 weeks, September 19th, for David and Sarah Grant. And as a little bit of a reminder, remember that Survivor ID card. You can find it at survivorid.org. And as I always say, if you like my show, tell 10 of your friends. If you hated it, well, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me, too. As the clock is ticking up to 6:50 Pacific time, I'm going to bid you all adieu. Please stay tuned to the next show with Matt Duffin. It'll start at 7 p.m. Pacific time. That's 10 Eastern and all time zones in between. So I will see you again on September 19th with David and Sarah Grant at the same time, same station, and good night all. Good night, Daniel. Good night, Lisa. Good night, Georgiana.
Good night.
Good night,
Thanks.
Donna.
Thank you.
Oh.
Good night. Bye-bye.